Hello, and welcome to Mega City Book Club, a podcast dedicated to the collected editions, old and new, from 2000 AD and Rebellion Publishing. I'm Eamon Clark, and each episode I'm joined by a different guest who chooses the book we're going to discuss. And for this episode, I'm delighted to have another 2000 AD fan who I had the pleasure of meeting through the regular Southern Contingent meetups. It's Steve Green. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Eamon.
How are you?
I'm great. Busy, but great. And quite hot. I would have the fan on at the moment. I'm sat by the window. I would have the fan on, but...
Probably a bit too noisy for our recording.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about what you're busy on later on.
Okay.
But first of all, as ever, you know the format by now. What is your 2000 AD origin story? How did you come to the comic, Steve?
Reader from Prog 1.
Another Prog 1-er.
Yeah, another Prog 1-er. We're ancient. I do remember sort of reading Action before that, and before that, the sort of like the IPC sort of like funnies, you know, like Whoopi, Monster Fun. I think I was always like, you know, a bit of a sci-fi geek, even like, you know, when I was a kid, so like Godzilla movies and things like that, and E. Ray Harryhausen and stuff, I sort of like lapped up. So I think my mum bought it. I think she probably saw like dinosaurs on the cover and go, oh yeah, and like that.
Steve will like that, yeah.
Yeah. So and that was it. And I think so. Like from the first issue, I mean, the Bellardinelli, like the Dan Dare stuff, that really sort of drew me in because that was, you know, so weird and alien looking, and just sort of like stuck around even through the '90s. So
you've been through the rough patches and back.
Been through the rough patches. I think it became, you know, a bit more like smoking really. So you just like do it out of habit, you know. It's sort of, you know, with the sort of like, you know, the promise that, oh, it will get better, you know, and it's sort of certainly around sort of like the late '90s, you know. I mean, sort of Andy Diggle sort of like time, and sort of the end of Dave Bishop sort of like time. It seemed to sort of like, you know, pick up. I find it even sort of interesting when you're not enjoying it, you can still analyse it and go, why am I not enjoying it? And you know, I even get a lot bit of that, you know, these days. You know, there's like certain strips where I go, I'm just not getting on with this. It's sort of, but I'm not really one to go on forums and just go and start sort of slagging stuff off. It's an anthology, you know, it sort of comes with the territory, really.
Exactly, yes. It's an anthology comic, and there's always going to be some strips that we really enjoy and some that perhaps we don't quite get so much. And, of course, there's always the constant of dread to keep coming back for more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, dread's, you know, pretty much constantly a sort of, you know, a high watermark. It's like, even the ones where, you know, like, which are a bit divisive, like the Last Sensitive Clegg sort of story. I mean, I loved it. I mean, it's all like, you know, all right, it's all like the characterization of Dredd was
a bit strange,
but
we love Sensitive Clegg, don't we?
But you know, you sort of like look at, you know, and I think, you know, all these people who sort of complain about sort of you know, saying, oh well, you know, John Wagner wouldn't have written it like that, you know. Yeah, I mean, you had a lot of Wagner Dredds and Alan Grant Dredds, and you know, where they're sort of whole musical numbers and things like that, and you know, there's sort of like Dredd sort of having a dream sequence where he's off to, you know, Oz, and, you know, it's a whole sort of Wizard of Oz pastiche, you know, we're going from black and white to colour. So I think it's just because people are so used to having the sort of post-Pitt Dredd, you know, be sort of fairly sort of like, you know, a bit straighter than the sort of like the wackier stuff. So anything that's, you know, slightly off that sort of like spec that comes along now, people just go, this isn't Dredd, you know. It's but, you know, Dredd for a good portion of it was pretty varied. You know, have sort of full-on horror, sort of Haunting of Sector House 9, you know, fast, you know, hard sci-fi. It's, it's pretty varied. And I just think the fact that it's sort of, it settled down for, you know, a bit of a period, and it's quite nice to like shake it up and just have something a bit different.
There's always been the wacky stories right from the Prog's origins, really, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, it's, consistency is all right, but it can get a bit boring. It's quite nice to like shake it up. I haven't read any of the IDW ones, which get a bit of a slating, but it's interesting. It's sort of, the year one sort of stuff that Matt wrote, you know, I really like that. And I'm quite surprised that they didn't go down that route. And I'd love to know what their sort of reasoning for it was. I think it's one thing to sort of like do, you know, the odd sort of like little crazy one but where you're sort of taking a real sort of strange turn, like the latest Megacity Zero one. I don't know how they're sort of like pitching it, because it takes it sort of so out of what people are used to, and it becomes a bit difficult for, you know, when you start like recommending stuff, it goes, well, you know, what dredge do you recommend? It's like, well, what kind of dredge do you like? You know, yes, exactly. do you like the funny stuff? Do you want the serious stuff? You know, especially coming off the back of the 2012 film. That's sort of ultra serious. And IDW were sort of almost, harking back to the sort of like the 80s, sort of like, you know, wackier dread, where it seems it would have made more sense. Like the year one stuff was, or it had the comic uniform, but tonally it was sort of closer to the movie. And, I don't know whether that was an intentional thing by Matt, but it seemed like, yeah, that was the route you should have gone and sort of appeal to that, because, you know, people sort of like, you know, on the movie, and they tend to sort of take it a bit more seriously, or a bit too seriously. Anything where you got sort of deputy goldfish and things like that are probably going to go, what the hell's this?
Yeah, what was this?
The whole sort of Ronald McDonald sort of thing. It's like, what's that? I don't get it.
Yes.
horses were courses.
Absolutely. And Judge Dredd Year One may, in fact, be coming up as a book on a future episode.
It's good. I mean, it's drawn by Simon Colby, who drew sort of part of the Mandroid, the second part of Mandroid. And I'm a big fan of Simon Colby's artwork, you know. He does the ugly side of Mega City 1 very well.
Yes, that's right. We're going to be talking about him in a moment. So, you've sort of mentioned it. Tell us about the book we're going to be talking about this time, Steve.
Yeah, Mandroid. So it all came up a bit because there's always this, people say, where do I start with Dredd? And it's a bit of a problem because, especially with like John's stuff, he sows the seeds across like decades of stories, you know, like plot lines will be sort of pulled up. It's like, what order did you read it in? And it's like, well, unless you start, so, you know, you can either sort of start at the beginning and work your way through it, but trying to pick sort of like individual ones which don't hark back to something else, like, you know, say, like, oh, well, this one's great, but it's got Orlok in it, and so if you want to read that, I'm going to have to read Block Mania, or go back sort of even further, you know, when the subplot's introduced. And this was quite a nice one. It's pretty much self-contained. I mean, it doesn't really sort of have any previous sort of like plot threads. And only at the end, it's sort of like, it has a bit of a sort of a bit of foreshadowing of, I think, the sort of Tour of Duty sort of, with, you know, Dredd being undermined. But the main reason I picked it, I mean, I just love Kev Walker's artwork. His artwork has, changed quite a little bit. I mean, this is a sort of, more minimalist Mike Mignola sort of like stage. I mean, I did own a page of his ABC Warriors artwork, which fully painted. It was a lot more detailed. I did own it to sell it. It sort of came back. I mean, he sort of had a... there was a switch to black and white where he's doing Balls Brothers and The Inspector, I think it was called.
Right.
That was sort of like black and white, sort of, you know, more detailed. It was a bit similar to sort of Colin McNeil sort of like style when he was in Maelstrom. And then it sort of like became sort of stripped back, you know, further. And I really like that, you know. I'm sort of more of a fan of black and white than I am, you know, colour. I mean, even though this is... sort of, you know, this is sort of like coloured artwork. And, so I looked at it, and, you know, it's got this sort of film noirish. I think he, looking at the credits, I think he coloured this one himself.
Yes.
With Pete Doherty doing the second part, who and Kev Walker, you know, didn't do the second part. I sort of looked into it, and it's one of those sort of like stories where Dredd's a bit of a minor character, you know, and it's that always sort of like crops up a little bit where, you know, people are talking about TV series and things like that and saying, oh, you know, Dredd doesn't necessarily have to be in it that much, you know, it's he can just be this sort of brooding presence on the sidelines. And, you know, this is more about, you know, Nate Slaughterhouse, you know, the sort of Mandroid of the strip. Although it's, you know, it seems a bit sort of sadistic, but I do quite like these sort of stories where, you know, you see somebody sort of crushed by Mega City One, and it's there's a couple of those sort of, you know, a few of those stories that John does where, you know, you got a predominantly good man and just terrible things, you know, happen to him and his family.
Awful things happen, yes. The city is quite unpleasant to him and his family, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also, it's nice to, I mean, sort of Dread act, I mean, it's all relative, but at its most sympathetic, you know, where Dredd's sort of trying to do right, and it's only when it's sort of like, you know, pushed to the limits, and you know, where he's got like zero tolerance for, you know, for vigilantes, and you know, Nate's become this sort of slightly more sympathetic version of the Punisher.
Yes,
it's like Punisher stroke RoboCop, and it's, you know, it's quite. I mean, it's almost. You can sort of see how, I mean, it's a bit similar to the Executioner, the old Carlos strip.
Oh, right, yep.
You know, but, you know, Dredd's a lot more sort of like sympathetic, you know, where, you know, it's almost like, you know, he doesn't want to believe it's him. You know, I think it actually sort of says that, so, you know, in the strip.
Yes, he doesn't want to, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just, you know, it's, I mean, the first part is just like, you know, beautifully grim. It's sort of you know, it's not really sort of like, you know, there's not many laughs to be had, but it's just sort of, it's so cinematic. I mean, you know, a lot of people sort of like, yeah, say that about a lot of Dredd strips, but you know, it's so sort of like, you know, well thought out, and I don't think it puts a foot wrong. It's I mean, I don't know whether you want to sort of like go to, you know, specifics on the plot, but...
Well, let me just do the credits for the first part. So, ran in Progs 1453 to 1464 in 2005. And as you've mentioned already, it's John Wagner, it's art and colours by Kev Walker, and it's lettered by Tom Frame. And what's the basic setup of the first book? Tell us about Nate's Slaughterhouse.
Yeah, so, I mean, Nate's basically a soldier or ex-soldier who's been fighting off-world, and he's terribly he's fighting these sort of aliens. I think they're called spooks in there.
I think that's how they refer to them, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no sort of like backstory to it. I mean, there's been sort of like off-world sort of stuff before, but there's always been this sort of like vague, oh, something's happening off-world, and Mega City's got a bit of an empire and things like that. But yeah, so he's horribly injured and sort of like basically sort of turned into a cyborg. So, you know, he's basically a torso. You know, the organics are a torso and a head, so sort of RoboCop levels of, you know, cybernetics. And, you know, he's married to another soldier, Kitty Rosson. And, you know, he's basically demobbed and goes back to Mega City One.
And tries to set up a life with their young son, Tommy.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, he's had this sort of horrible sort of thing happen to him, and go back to Mega City One, and hopefully, you know, they're hoping for a new start. Yeah, he still has all his cybernetics. And, yeah, it all goes worse.
It all goes horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah.
You mentioned, I mean, you've already mentioned film noir, and I thought it was a very film noir type tale of a man
coming
back from war and struggling to find his place in a mean city. There is a sort of noirish theme there, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the story, and, you know, obviously in the artwork, you know, it's all very sort of like stark shadows and sort of foggy and rain. And yeah, I mean, it's got a bit of the sort of like Sin City sort of, you know, vibe to it, you know, sort of like comparison with you know, other comics, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting sort of just seeing because not like the first strip, I mean, it sort of Dredd's only in the sort of like the last panel, so, you know, like I say, this, you know, a very, very sort of like Dredd light thing, you know, he's just his presence, and then it's quite a good introduction to Mega City One as well, you know, the whole setup of, you know, the city blocks and, you know, just the general background to it. And one thing sort of like John has set up on a previous strip, you know, was a thought that, yeah, you'd have these sort of, you know, block warlords, you know, like Mama, that, you know, somebody who would run the whole block, you know, they'd have like the block daddy or the, you know, the block mother. And in this case, it's a guy called Schultz.
Denzo Schultz.
Yeah, so they run sort of protection rackets and basically anything that's sort of criminal in the block sort of like comes under there. So you have these initially sort of like pleasant sort of like people who would come through and say, we sort of sell you these insurance policies, you know, just running a protection racket, and they're sort of completely oblivious to what they're doing. You know, and it sort of starts off that, you'd be paying this extortionate stuff and you don't pay up, then it'd be stuff through the letterbox or, you know, fire set or things like that until you pay up. It gives that impression of sort of like, you know, the judges being sort of overstretched, so that, you know, they can't really do much because the block daddies are so far removed from the actual sort of like the foot soldiers who are doing all the dirty work. I think on this one you've got this whole thing where the block daddies have, you know, had their voice boxes removed to get out the problem of the whole lie detector sort of thing, which
the famous way round the lie detector.
Yeah, John made a rod for his own back on that one. So you know, there's all, you know, that side of thing. So it's just all brooding, and it's all like, you know, it's just got this sort of like, you know, set up. And I mean, the thing that actually sort of the trigger, you know, for everything is Kitty's disappearance. She goes for a job interview, a place called Bleak Industries. Was their slogan, "The future's bright, the future's bleak."
Yes, terrible, isn't it?
She disappears, and I'm pretty sure it's not actually it's not actually Schultz that sets that up. You know, it's just a random occurrence. But yes, then
Dredd suspects it's organ leggers who've got her.
Yeah, but it sets everything in like chain of motion where he gets arrested, and interrogated, and it just escalates from there. So yeah, eventually they sort of decide to. He decides to take revenge on Slaughterhouse, and his Tommy is killed.
Yes, the son is killed horribly, and as you say, he then becomes Nate Slaughterhouse. Then becomes like the Punisher or Death Wish or something like that, isn't it? And the tale becomes even darker, and as you say, more shadows, more strange crimes going on in back alleys.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing where Nate was on the edge anyway, you know, not sure of his sort of like place in the world, you know, sort of struggling with sort of his own sort of like self-loathing that, he wasn't quite a man anymore. There was all these sort of like problems, and now his wife is missing, his son is definitely dead, and he's just got nothing to live for. So, you know, basically any sort of like crime that he's sort of coming across, you know, he's just going crazy. And because it's sort of like cybernetics, you know, he's got this sort of, it's like a bionic commando type extendable sort of fist stroke grappling hook thing, you know, which is he uses. And it's there's some just sort of stunning sort of like, you know, sort of like shots where, you know, Nate's got off the leash.
In his mandroid body, which is almost perfectly designed for what he becomes, this sort of grim avenger of crime.
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of see it, it's sort of like building up to it. I mean, it doesn't sort of come out of nowhere. I mean, you know, these ones where, before Tommy's sort of killed, there's a guy sort of holding a knife to him, and all he does, he just sort of grabs a knife and snaps it, and then sort of like, and then he doesn't go fully crazy, but once Tommy's gone, then he's completely a lost soul.
Yes, he is, that's right. Nothing to live for except the possibility of getting his vengeance on the criminals of Mega City One.
Yeah, I mean, so looking at it is you can sort of see, I'm just looking at the page where Tommy's sort of going to recycle, and it just shows how horrible Mega City One is, where the priest is saying, like, you know, you don't want to watch him on the belt. You know, many people find it a comfort. I mean, anybody who knows what Recyc is, you know, it's basically just a big sort of like mincing machine, you know, and it's you got this sort of thing where you got these sort of discreet curtains and things like that. It's, and it's like, so why would you want to sort of like, you know, see it's all after that? But that's Mega City One for you.
Yes, absolutely. And then we get Nate Slaughterhouse walking home in the snow. He's got very much to sort of like the noir hero's big overcoat
yeah
turned up, he sort of comes across a random mugging, and they try to turn their attentions to him. And of course, then he just uses his abilities as a mandroid, and he's set on the path of this grim Avenger becoming, as you say, the Punisher.
Yeah, I mean, there's that sort of that shot. You know, it's the sort of Dirty Harry type shot, I guess. The, you know, the sort of gun low in the frame. It's blood splatters and it's
snow and blood splatters. Yes.
Yeah.
You mentioned Kev Walker's artwork, and you also compared it to Mike Mignola. Which I think is a very apt comparison. It does have that sort of, in places, that sort of Hellboy look to it. But you also mentioned Frank Miller and Sin City, and I was thinking of another Frank Miller comic. I don't know if you know Ronin.
Yeah.
And the sort of organic look of some of the mega city buildings that Kev Walker does, plus the story of a sort of limbless character who gains a sort of power through a cybernetic suit. There's some similarities there. I mean, I often think that's one of Frank Miller's most underrated comics, Ronin, and perhaps one of his better ones that doesn't get the attention.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of his later stuff, got a bit of the baggage with his other things that he's been saying, and
his political views have gotten away. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Shame. But yeah, an interesting comic to go back and look at, Frank Miller's Ronin. But yeah, here we have Kev Walker, and it gets darker and darker, and some of the pages are just almost all greys and blacks and shadows, and it's very noir. As you say, there's a fog, and it's tremendous stuff, the artwork by Kev Walker. It is just lovely to look at.
There's a frame sort of, it's just after... You know, he's sort of totally gone off the rails, where he got like the shadow of there's a picture of him and Kitty, and you know, he got like the shadow of the pistol that he's holding, and it's the shadow sort of blocking out him, you know, where, you know, it's basically him lost, and then it sort of switches to the judges sort of like coming across the scene of where he's sort of taking out this sort of these muggers, and then it's sort of like back into sort of mist and fog, and it's basically Nate sort of on the prowl to sort of like, you know, rather than actually stumbling across criminals, you know, he's actually going out on the hunt for them. It's starting to go into the sort of similar to the, you know, the RoboCop sort of thing, you know, where it's going on a drugstore and sort of like, you know, actually being a bit more proactive.
Yes. One of the things I love about doing this podcast is when my guests point out stuff that I hadn't noticed, because I'm looking at that page now with Nate holding the gun. He's standing in shadow. And then when it turns to the picture of him and his wife, as you say, the shadow of the gun falls right across him, blocking him out. It's I hadn't noticed that before.
I'm presuming sort of like Kev sort of... that was sort of Kev's choice. I mean, you know, John strips are sort of quite sparse, and he just leaves it to the artist sort of like to do that. So, you know, I don't know if that was a choice with sort of like Kev. And, you know, and you look at that, and, you know, like the frames below that, you know, he's all, you know, the panel before that, he's all in shadow, you know, and the panel before that. So, you know, just slowly getting, you know, it's almost like an eclipse in three panels. Maybe reading slightly too much into it, but...
No, I don't think so. I think you're quite right. I think Kev Walker's directing here, and he's using noir themes and shadows. The shadow of the gunman is very, it's very impressive. Thank you for pointing that out, actually. It's remarkable stuff.
And of course, Kev did a lot of stuff on the concept stuff of the Stallone film as well. So it's, huge amounts of... concept work for that.
Yes.
You know, he's obviously, you know, got this, most comic book artists, you know, do have like a cinematic eye, you know, but you can especially see it in this.
He's off working for Marvel, I think, mostly now, isn't he?
I don't really sort of like pay a huge amount of attention to sort of like what's going on with sort of the big two. So, I do read the occasional sort of things where it's sort of 2000-y alumni, it tends to be more sort of like the independent sort of stuff. I mean, I'm recently reading Unfollow, which is sort of Rob Williams and Mike Dowling.
Yes, that is that's a splendid ongoing at the moment.
Yeah, but I think a lot of that is down to space and time. yeah. and money.
Yes, and there's so much to this stuff for
the Holy Three, you know. Yeah. It's, yeah, so, you know, moving along, it's all, yeah, it's like sort of grey and black. And
then it builds up to this sort of climax to book one, which is where he meets up with some of his old Space Corps buddies, and he gets kitted out this time with the full battle suit and heads north for the final showdown with Dino Schultz.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is up in Canada. Canada sort of like it's like one of these sort of like places that never really gets mentioned that much in Dread. You know, there's somewhere called Freetown, which is I think on the border.
Yes. So he's heading into the frozen north in this.
Actually, no. Sorry, Freetown's in book two, but
that's right, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, he's sort of heading up to you know, Boss Schultz has got this hideout, stroke fortress, up in the Canadian wastes, basically sort of Dread's, as you know, said. You know, this is where he is, and it's I don't know, slightly not Dread-like. I mean, I've seen sort of like, you know, Dread, you know, where he said, like, we don't, you know, let criminals do our dirty work for him, but I think he's just you know, using slaughterhouses as a means to an end, and can get both of them in the same place. But yeah, I mean, then it's all snow and again bleak, and so I noticed that always like John Magnus robots. Yeah, you got Curly, Larry, and Mo, the three sort of like bodyguard.
They're lovely robots. Aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, robots for like for Boss Schultz. But yeah, and then there's the twist at the, you know, at the end that Kitty is alive, sort of.
Yes.
You know, of a fashion. It sort of turns out that the sort of organ leggers who've basically you know, stolen a body and implanted something in her brain, so her personality's gone. You know, it's just a more or less a robot. You know, it's then full on action. You know, up to the end. You know, with sort of Dread sort of hovering over everything as he is. I mean, he's just basically been, you know, this sort of presence, sort of like waiting to see, you know, whether Nate puts a step wrong, and now he knows that he's irredeemable. He's just gonna, you know, wait for him to sort of make his move.
Yes, I mean, as you said, Dread is a sort of peripheral character as we follow Nate Slaughterhouse pretty much through the whole story. But you know, his character is quite interesting from John as ever, where, as you've said, he's almost sympathetic to Slaughterhouse and his family. Although, you know, I think at several points he tells him, you know, leave it to us, Slaughterhouse, we'll deal with it. And of course, you know, the story demands that he doesn't. Yeah, it's very interesting. And, I wonder what Dredd thinks about this mandroid who's now, you know, more robot than man in some places, in some regards.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, I can't remember, you know, when this was published. Was it sort of like
2005. Early 2000s?
You know, it's got to the stage where, you know, Dredd's a bit more nuanced with, you know, regards to what he'll let slide and... All right, he's always been a stickler, but I think sort of he sort of mellowed slightly with age, and he'd rather sort of like you know, when he sees a sort of good, he probably seems like see so many of the bad. You know, when he sees someone of the good, he's sort of inclined to sort of stretch it a little bit, you know, with them until they've overstepped the line. But sort of yeah, and maybe he sees it, you know, something of himself in sort of Slaughterhouse, or both soldiers of a sort, and. Yeah, sort of just trying to sort of, you know, do the best I can. But yeah, it's one of those areas where sort of like Dredd's been opened up a little bit, you know, because otherwise it could get very dull where it's just, you know, Dredd shooting somebody for littering sort of type thing. It's, I think, you know, you start to run out of, you know, how much of a hard arse he can be.
Yeah, as you say, this makes Dredd much more interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, you know, it's...
This character with, you know, a few sympathies for a good family caught up in terrible things in Mega City 1. And as you say, he may see some similarities between himself and Slaughterhouse. And then towards the end of the story, he seems to be using Slaughterhouse to get to the crime boss.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a proxy. I mean, it does sort of like, you know, get stretched a bit. It's, you know, where, you know, Dredd's using a vigilante for his own ends. But there's always a, you know, a bit of elasticity where, these things are sort of like concerned. I don't want to be that fan where, oh, Dredd would never do that. You know, it's, well, it's whatever the writers want to, you know, want to write. It's one of those things where it makes for a better story. I think a lot of people just want to, in an instruction manual, you know, they just want to, you know, have everything sort of like driven by logic, and it can, all right, it might be sort of satisfying in one way, but it can make for a very dull story.
Yes, absolutely. If Dredd just turns up and, as you say, shoots the mugger and that's the end of the story, it's a bit dull. This is far more interesting, and book one is just fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, sort of looking through the sort of like, you know, the last part of it, I'm presuming Kev did the sound effects as well, the lettering for the sound effects, and I'm a big fan of those sort of those sort of things. Where, I mean, I think Colin McNeil does and Frank Whiteley does a few of those sort of things, you know, big fooms and.
Yes, Shrang, Badder Dooms. Yeah. Yes, there's a few of those which are great. Yeah, as the mandroid in the battle suit takes on the robots and the defences of Dino Schultz.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's book one. Great stuff. 2 years later, 2007, Progs 1555 to 1566, we get the second mandroid story. Again, John Wagner. As you say, we've got Simon Colby on art for the first couple of episodes, and then Carl Critchlow takes over. Peter Doherty colours and Annie Park has letters throughout. And, of course, we've got Nate Slaughterhouse now with a very much reduced mandroid body. They've taken away all these sort of military capabilities, and he's in an ISO block. And, of course, Wagner has to engineer a way of getting him out of there, which he does actually, I think, in a quite compelling episode. The escape is particularly well done.
Yeah, I mean, sort of Nate Slaughterhouse, it's slightly sort of strange in, I mean, John's famously sort of kills off characters. So you could have quite imagined that he would have, you know, he might have died at the end of, you know, the first book, you know, the Dredd would have killed him.
Yes, absolutely. He, as you say, he doesn't keep his characters hanging around very long sometimes.
Yes, you know, which is only sort of, you know, PJ, maybe Judge Death and Me Machine that are the, you know, the ones that have had a, you know, one of them is an undead zombie. So, two of them are an undead zombies, really. So, yeah, you know, this is all quite unusual. Like I say, Simon Colby sort of like, you know, does ugly characters very well. I mean, there's a panel on the third page, you know, where it's you know, Nate sort of dreaming of, you know, it's sort of like flashbacks to his life with Kitty, and he's the sort of like plasty skin over the sort of the robot body. And I remember sort of Simon did a really good, it was another John Wagner story, I think it's called My Beautiful Career, where it was a citizen who was basically used as a crash test dummy of sorts by the Justice Department, yeah, and until he couldn't take it anymore. So, you know, he was used at the Academy of Law as a citizen to basically beat up and, you know, end up with, you know, cybernetics and colostomy bags and sort of things like that. And it was all like pipes going in. It was, you know, a great story. And it was very similar to Mandroid. It was like another citizen broken by the city. And, you know, you can sort of see it, you know, I think, not sure, you know, whether this came before that story, but certainly a lot of similarities. And Simon Colby's got a, you know, a great sort of a great style for that sort of thing. It's a shame that he didn't continue to do the rest of it, because, you know, there's a bit of a, you know, a jarring jump between him and Carl Critchlow's art. So yeah, I mean, you got this sort of, you know, this escape where, you know, basically Nate's down to just his sort of like torso, you know, with a sort of and managing to escape, really, you know, literally using his teeth to sort of,
yes, absolutely,
you know, crawl over into the sort of like laundry duct, and the judges sort of getting berated by Dredd for letting him go. He goes, well, he had no arms and no legs. You know, I didn't think he was going anywhere. But
yes, the hapless Judge Whittle, who crops up throughout this story and often is the victim of Dredd's ire, because he constantly underestimates Nate Slaughterhouse and was supposed to be gardening when he was in the hospital. So yeah, poor old Whittle manages to let Slaughterhouse slip through his fingers, and he's escaped and falls into the hands of a mad general, Trigg Vincent.
Yeah, there was sort of Trigg sort of, like, one thing I noticed was, like, rereading it was how he uses God rather than Grud. I don't know whether that was intentional or not, you know, but considering to, like, you know, pretty much it's always Grud in Dreadworld.
Yeah.
It's, it just sort of struck me as sort of slightly strange. But again, you know, the Trigg Vincent's got a big robot bodyguard.
Yes, a big military robot, and also a robot surgeon, Dr. Stanner, who build a new body for Nate Slaughterhouse.
I always like John Wagner's robots. That sort of thing. You know, the public defender droid is sort of is always like a favourite. You know, the one who sort of plays violin music when he's trying to get people off.
Right.
We're now on this, like, a switch to Carl Critchlow's art. Yeah, Carl Critchlow, great artist, but yeah, it just felt like a bit of a, you know, a bit too I don't know, not moody enough as compared to, you know, Simon or Kev's artwork, a bit too light.
Yes, there's a change in tone, and it becomes perhaps, well, we know Carl Critchlow's art, you know, it is a slight change. He does become a little bit more perhaps cartoony in places.
Yeah, and also I think, because, you know, I mean, Carl Critchlow's sort of well known for Lobster Random, so you start to sort of see when one artist has done a sort of particular strip, you know, you start to see a bit of the sort of things. I know it's the sort of, like, the baggage that comes with sort of doing one particular strip.
I think he does lovely stuff once Nate's got his new body and he's sent to test it at this place that you've mentioned, Freetown, on the Canadian border, a sort of hive of scum and villainy, I suppose, as you'd say, Mos Cantina sort of style. And he cleans it out in sort of brutal and violent fashion. And I thought the artwork on those pages was quite stunning, you know, of the mandroid in action.
Yeah, I think sort of, like, you know, that's sort of where it's going down a bit more into the sort of, like, you know, dark greys and sort of yellows of the flame. Trigg Vincent is, you know, Nate's found out that Kitty is still alive. Well, that he's managed to acquire sort of Kitty's body. And basically, sort of, Trigg is lying and saying that, you know, her personality's still there. And basically, there's a quite a sort of you know, nasty trick that he plays on Nate, that going along with illusion that she is actually recovering, whereas in fact all she's being used is a mouthpiece for Trigg's daughter Melody, who's terminally ill, and Trigg's plan is to do a body swap.
Yes, it's a gruesome reveal by John Wagner again, as he shifts. Pulls the rug out from under Nate and from us as well. And you get that weird sort of irony in that, you know, Nate is a human mind trapped in this robot body. And Kitty appears to be, you know, perfect human body, but her mind is not her own. It's been controlled elsewhere.
Yeah,
it's very good stuff. And of course, that's the sort of bargaining chip that Trigg Vincent uses, that Kitty will be, you know, she'll recover her memories of Nate, and they'll be able to get their life back. So he's using this to get Nate to do various things. And of course, he's got this criminal mastermind plan that's building up.
Yeah, I mean, it's seems to be sort of like Mega City One has a coup every every couple of years. It's a plan to hit a Justice Department warehouse, which has hundreds of mechanoids, sort of mechanismo robots.
To gain control of all the mechanismo robots and the robot tanks and take over Mega City One.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, like, you know, yeah, that is a bit of a callback there. You know, it's talking about sort of the Nero Narcos, sort of the Doomsday for Dread and Doomsday for Mega City One,
which I think is mentioned at some point, isn't it?
Yeah. It's sort of it doesn't really sort of, you know, you don't really need to know that much about it. I mean, it's, you know, literally just sort of one line. So yeah, that, you know, that, that's his sort of like, you know, grand plan, and you know, using Nate as the as a pawn.
Yeah, and in a way, you know, you don't need to know too much about the master plan either, because it's almost incidental. While we have got the story of Nate and Kitty and this sort of developing relationship between them, and as you say, the final reveal that it's not Kitty all along, it's actually the general's, I think it's his granddaughter, isn't it?
His granddaughter, Melody.
Melody,
yeah.
Who has got a terrible disease called venereal palsy. Another 2000 AD created disease, I think. And she's sort of basically supplying the voice and the mind control for Kitty remotely, which is revealed. And it leads to, I mean, we see here, we see Dredd doing interrogations of some of Nate's old army buddies.
Yeah.
And the interrogations are terrible. They're quite, you know.
Yeah, electroshock.
Electroshock therapy, and all sorts of things. Yes, brutal interrogations. But once Dredd sort of comes across Melody and the truth of what's going on, again, we see this slightly sympathetic attitude from Dredd, and a perhaps surprising conclusion, really.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, I do love the, I mean, basically, Dredd sort of like takes over the sort of the control unit for Kitty. So you basically got Kitty sort of like talking with Dredd's voice, which, yeah, that must have been a bit of a shock.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Nate was leading this sort of ragtag bunch of former Space Corps mercenaries who were going to take this Justice Department warehouse and seize control of the Mechanismo robots. But Dredd intervenes by taking over Kitty because she was going along with them.
Yeah,
it's tremendous. I really enjoyed that, actually. I thought the way John Wagner handled that, and again, this sort of insight into Dredd's character, that he's allowed to be slightly more nuanced, slightly more sympathetic, and not just the, you know, a full assault, full high X on the gun and away he goes.
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty much doing spoilers all the way through. So
yeah, so
I mean, it basically ends with sort of Slaughterhouse sort of overloading the suit and shooting himself in the head with sort of high explosives, and sort of takes out what's left of Kitty and himself. So yeah, that's the end of Nate Slaughterhouse.
I'm afraid so. No happy ending for Nate.
No. Kitty. So yeah. I mean, the only thing that sort of left us a bit of a loose thread is Judge Whittle, you know, where I can't remember whether that does lead into sort of Tour of Duty, you know, where it's, you know, they're basically putting all the blame on Dredd for screwing up.
If you ask me, the old man's going soft. Yeah, it's an interesting little sort of nod forward to what's going to come with later Dredd stories from John Wagner. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so we'll just have a quick look. I mean, there's a bit of a sort of covers gallery. So there's a Mark Harrison one with, it's pretty much a Terminator.
So, yep, absolutely.
We've got a lovely sort of moody sort of Kev Walker one with Nate in the battle suit.
That's a beautiful cover. Yeah, the battle suit, the glowing green, and then this sort of just the ghost of Dredd's helmet behind him.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a beautiful Kev Walker cover.
I'd love to know sort of like what the original artwork for that looks like, because you know, I don't imagine Dredd's probably on a separate layer, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's probably pretty sparse. Then we've got another one by Rufus with some Electrotone.
Yeah, Rufus.
He likes his Electrotone.
He does, yes. It's very nice.
And then, there's a cover by Peter Doherty. It's an unusual sort of for a cover. Yeah, because it's like a lot of sort of split panels. So it's,
it actually looks like a page from the prog rather than a cover, doesn't it? It looks like, but without any sort of voice bubbles or captions.
I wonder whether Peter was maybe in the frame for drawing some of it.
Right, whether that might be an early page that he was working.
Yeah, and just got repurposed. But
yeah. We see Nate, we see Kitty, we see General Vincent, and just down below at the bottom we've got Dredd's chin.
Yeah, it would have been quite interesting to see sort of Peter doing the sort of like the second half, because he would have been quite a good fit as well. It's remember, bury my knee at Wounded Heart.
That's exactly the story I was just thinking of. Another pair of citizens chewed up by the big city.
And slightly sympathetic Dread.
Yes, absolutely. Dread making an unexpected choice at the end of that story. And as you say, that's a beautiful Peter Doherty story.
I mean, I do wonder sort of whether, I'd love to see sort of like a almost, not quite cover versions, but like other artists take a crack at a classic strip and... nobody's ever really sort of done that. You know, you get sort of, I know sort of financially it's probably not viable, but it would be sort of quite interesting to sort of see another artist sort of, you know, take one of John's scripts and just sort of that's already been drawn by another artist.
Yeah,
I know it's sort of, you know, I don't mean it to be sort of slightly insulting to an existing artist, but I just think it'd be interesting, you know, because it's, you know, otherwise it's just like having one song that's only, you know, been covered by one artist. It's doesn't necessarily mean that somebody else shouldn't sort of take a crack at it.
And talking of John's scripts, I've got in mind, I think if you have as well, the script for part one, the first episode of Mandroid. So we actually get to see a bit of John Wagner's scripting. And as you say, he does leave a lot for the artists to work with themselves, I think. You know, he's famous for having fairly sort of minimalist instructions for his artists. He just lets them get on with it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see the script. Yeah, it's nice to have that at the back of this book. It's lovely.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I've seen a lot of John's scripts a few times, and I was sort of helping out, Greg with Dark Justice. So I saw the scripts of that, you know, in advance, and they're still pretty minimal.
Right, okay. Still leaving a lot to the artists. Well, there you were involved with Greg Staples and Dark Justice. Fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I was just taking a few photos, really, so just for some reference. But it's quite nice to sort of see it, you know, evolve and go through the process.
Do you still own any of Kev Walker's art at all?
No, afraid not. And I needed some money for I had a few pieces of art, and there was a Jock piece and a couple of Simon Fraser ones. So I think Guy Robbins had those.
All right.
It was a shame, but.
If there was a page from Mandroid, either book one or book two,
right,
or a cover that you'd like to own the original artwork for, is the one you could pick out?
I think it's the end of second or third episode. It's basically the one where, it might be further along, it's the one where Dread finally twigs that Nate's the culprit.
Oh, right, okay.
Nate sort of come back and sort of dredged there, holding the sort of like the overcoat with the holes in it.
Ah, yes, I know the one.
And it's just quite moody. I mean, it's not a big action piece or, you know, anything like that. It's it's just like, I've been waiting for you, Slaughterhouse, and sort of like dredging the shadows, you know, holding the coat. And I think it was just because that was the end of the episode, you go, oh, as the kids say, shit's about to get real.
Yes. It's a lovely moody page. I'm looking at it now. It's very film noir again. Nate walking home in the snow, and then Dredd just waiting for him in his apartment, holding up the coat as evidence. Yeah, great stuff.
I mean, the couple of pages after that are great as well. I mean, they're sort of they're wonderful. Like, you know, Dredd getting smacked in the face by Nate's extendable arm.
And then the escape through the window. Out he goes.
Yeah, into the snow and sort of lots of shards of glass. So it's.
I must admit, I'm particularly taken by the very, very first page of Mandroid, which is the battle suits on the alien world image of these sort of floating, triffid, tentacled monsters, whatever they are, and battling out almost alone. Yeah, I love that page. But yeah, beautiful stuff. Okay. So Mandroid, there it is. I guess we're saying it's an essential read because it is just such a perfect introduction to Dredd and his world, isn't it?
Yeah, like I say, I mean, it's one of those ones where you don't have to know anything about, you know, there's not really any baggage for, you know, you don't need to know anything about the Apocalypse War or Blockmania or anything like that, that any of the other ones that I sort of had to come with. You know, people would go, oh, he could sort of, you know, read America at all. America sort of similar but sort of slightly atypical, sort of Dredd's a little bit more sympathetic in this. It's so yeah, that's one of my sort of like picks of if you're going to read one sort of Dredd, then this isn't a bad one to
Yes, we're always looking for that Dredd volume to hand to new readers, you know, particularly those perhaps who've been brought in by the recent movie. And this one, yeah, I think, is a, as you say, this is a perfect choice.
Yeah,
you don't need much background on Dredd at all to get into this story.
Yeah, I mean, it's not too wacky, and it's sort of, it's, you know, I mean, it's got enough of the sort of oddness of Megacity One. I think the city block is sort of like Dean Gaffney, you know,
yes,
the EastEnders soap actor, and it's like this sort of line about Dean Gaffney, the ugly face of megacity housing, or something. Yes. Like some, yeah, I don't know quite how that would translate to like a major feature film.
No, perhaps not.
Who's this guy? You know,
And then we have the wonderfully named Charmin O'Fletcher, who comes to greet them from. Yeah. Gaffney Life, the insurance company, and she gives them a cake and the offer of this protection, basically.
Yeah.
Charming O'Fletcher, wonderful.
Fantastic story, you know, it's I mean, especially, you know, I mean, art issues aside, I mean, it's a good on the second half, and, you know, I think it's just, you know, again, that's just my sort of quibbles with, you know, I don't think I was quite the right artist for that particular story. But you know, you do get that all, you know, that happens quite a lot. it's like Ian Gibson on, I think, City of the Damned. You know, I thought that was a bit of a strange one for that. Ian Gibson sort of suits the sort of like crazy citizen sort of type stories, you know, more than that.
The strange horror stories.
Yeah, it's but, you know, you do get that all over, you know. I don't mind it so much when sort of artists change, but you know, because, like, you know, like Brian and Mick are sort of like totally different on Cursed Earth, but just you do get these sort of occasional ones. I think it was maybe like Andy Digger was sort of saying on the ABC Warriors one, where he actually liked that, where you know, when they did the Return to Mars, and he basically sort of aped that sort of thing. Oh, we're going to have this artist this week and this artist that week. So, you know, there's like Carlos and Mick and Liam Sharp and I think Henry Flint. Yeah, I don't know. I can see the point, but sometimes it's quite nice to have a nice consistent sort of thing. You know, like the Henry Flint on doing Titan and Enceladus.
Yes, which may also be coming up on a future episode.
Oh yes. There's lots of them, sort of. There's lots of good, solid sort of, like, you know, collections. I mean, Dredd's always, you sort of like spoiled rotten for choices on that. I think it's one that, you know, apart from, you know, that bit of a blip in the 90s, it's pretty consistently good, and sort of often sort of, you know, that strong sort of like backbone of 2000 AD.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's Mandroid, a great John Wagner Dredd story. And if you want to buy it, the paperback version is still available, I think, on the Amazon marketplace. Or if you want nice hardback, the Hachette Mega Collection, it was issue number 6, which is volume 25, by the way, they do their strange numbering. That's out there, so you can get that. Or you can get it digitally for $9.99 from the 2000 AD store, or for the apps for Apple, Android and Windows 10 devices. And I've been looking at the digital version, which does include those covers at the back and the John Wagner script as well for episode 1. So you do get those in the digital version as well, which is quite nice. So it's that part of the podcast where my guest gets to tell me a bit about their own projects. So, Steve, what can you tell us about? I'm sure everybody who's listened to this podcast has seen Judge Minty, or at least I hope they have. But what can you tell us about Judge Minty, and also about what's to come in the future?
I mean, Judge Minty, we started it probably around 2008-ish, something like that.
Right.
It took an eon to do, as these sort of things do, where you're trying to fit them around your projects. But I mean, basically, Steve Sherlockini had an idea about doing a Dredd sort of fan film, and had been in contact with Dan Carey George at Planet Replicas. Although I think Planet Replicas didn't even exist at that time, about doing a Dredd helmet and a Dredd costume. I think originally at the time we were looking at doing more of a sort of more like the 2012 version, where it's a bit more of a riot cop sort of thing.
Oh, right, yeah.
I can't remember when the decision was made to go, you know, more comic book. I think it was Wise, because it's always that sort of thing where you get a bit of a, almost like a free pass if you're a bit more authentic. Whereas if you sort of start changing stuff, then, I think it's a bit more of an uphill struggle. And also it's interesting to sort of see whether, you know, that whole argument, they go, oh, that costume would never work in real life sort of thing. Basically, he'd already been in touch with Dan, and I met Dan at something called a Monster Maker. It was a little show stroke exhibition where people who made props were just showing off their work. And I sort of got chatting with Dan there, and he was a 2000 AD fan. I was a 2000 AD fan, and I think he had like Rogue Trooper's gunner and a Dredd helmet. And I spotted that, and sort of got chatting, and then. Yeah, we sort of went from the end. He sort of mentioned that, Steve wanted to do a film, and I thought, oh, I can do visual effects, sort of.
So, splendid.
You know, I said, oh, I'll get in touch, and went from there. And then I sort of talked myself into sort of thinking that it'd be a better idea if I actually shot it as well. So I didn't end up with sort of shots which were really, really hard to do the effects with, or... because there are things like, you know, where you can either sort of like just, you know, have the camera on a tripod, but it's pretty dull, or you can shoot it handheld and track stuff in and sort of, you know, see what could be done. I mean, you know, at the time I just thought it would be sort of pretty minimal, you know, minimal stuff. But then the sort of, you know, the more you get into it, you know, when you're sort of going to, you know, on a location shoot, go, all right, oh, I've done this and that looks really good. Oh, I'm going to have to do that for every shot. So, you know, so add a bit of dust and, you know, to make it feel a bit more apocalyptic and a bit less North Wales. Because, you know, we took a shot most of the Cursed Earth up in a place called Dunorwig, which every time it pops up on a feature film, it was using the Clash of the Titans remake. It's popped up in the latest Tarzan film. I sort of saw it on trailer and go, that's to Norwich. So,
you can spot the location.
Yeah, spot Slate from a mile away. It was interesting, just sort of like seeing what could be done and, you know, what you could do on a budget, what the hurdles were. And, we sort of like took the basic strip and then sort of expanded upon that.
All right, okay.
It was fun. I mean, it's, you know, you're always up against sort of things with sort of like weather and whatnot. It was it's a bit wetter than we'd expect the Cursed Earth to be.
It's like, it was North Wales.
Yeah. It's you're a bit limited unless you start going out of the country, and then you've got all the sort of problems of sort of, you know, getting all the props and costumes, and it's just generally logistics of the big thing. We did that, and it sort of started showing it around sort of 2012, because, you know, we knew this, or like, you know, Dredd was sort of coming out, and I can't remember when it was announced, but I think it was before we'd actually started shooting. So we were a bit sort of, are we going to get a cease and desist, or, you know, because you never know with these sort of things. There's no real hard and fast rules about, you know, what people will allow. I mean, there's a thing going on at the moment with a Star Trek sort of film called Axanar, which is sort of has overstepped the mark. They raised about $1 million, whereas, you know, we were basically, no, we're just sort of financially crippling ourselves. You know, we're not raising any money. I mean, we'd been in touch with Rebellion every sort of like step of the way, you know, and have a pretty good relationship with them. So as long as you don't talk crowdfund, they're fine with it. But
and as you say, you you weren't making any money out of it.
Yeah, I think that goes a long way.
Yes, absolutely. So there's Judge Minty, which obviously you can YouTube.
It's on YouTube. It's on Vimeo. Yeah, I mean, if you just, you know, Google YouTube Judge Minty, it's pretty easy to find. And we put a few sort of extra bits up there with, you know, because we had a lot of material, especially like the audio material for Radio Chatter and things like that, which Jared Butler and the guys in the States, they did a lot of work on that. So, you know, we thought it was worth sort of putting up a separate edit of just all that sort of stuff. Although, you know, you do get sort of like the occasional obsessive, you know, saying, oh, that guy who's that judge who's going off for 30 minutes sort of like rest time or, you know, personal time or something like that. What's he up to?
Right.
God, it's just a throwaway thing.
It's, you know, just a line.
Like, it's just a line, you know. It's like, you can read anything into it, you know. You just, well, you wrote it. Well, I think Mike Carroll probably wrote that bit, but... You know, it's just a line, you know, you can make it what you want, you know, you could be a bent judge, you know, just up to nefarious activities, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so Judge Minty, the best Judge Dredd film out there, in my opinion, that's out there. What we got to look forward to? What's coming in the future?
Well, we're doing Strontium Dog, so... although I'm going to have to finish it before we get into a real... dystopian future Britain.
We're nearly there already. Yes.
Yeah. So I think I said to Steve, so I'm just gonna bury my head in Strontium Dog. So if I'm gonna have to live in a dystopian future Britain, I'm gonna go with the ones with the cool gadgets and weapons.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's that's all finished shooting, hopefully. I mean, we've got everything, unless there's some things like jarring. I mean, I keep looking at things going, I could maybe sort of shoot that little bit better, you know. It's but it's just like minor sort of like pickups or things just to make it flow a bit better. And yeah, it's just like a lot of post-production, more than Minty, right. Really. It's I mean, just by the nature of that, you know, well, Johnny Alpha's eyes have got to glow,
of course. Yes,
so doing that for, you know, all the shots with him in, and it's I mean, I've got a pretty good sort of, you know, method for doing it, but there's some shots where it's very, very dark. We shot in a place called Fort Borstal, which is about as dark and grim as,
right.
as the name suggests. It's like an old sort of like an old army base or something, like right. stone sort of stone fort, and you know, there's bits in there where, you know, the lights weren't great, and to. Even though you can't actually really sort of like see his eyes in the actual footage, so I'm having to sort of brighten that up, track his face, and sort of track sort of like glowing eyes in there. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, if I could have found a way of doing it practically that was safe, I would love to have done that. I did see somebody did a Loki costume, and it looked, I mean, but they did it so his eyes lit up practically using UV lights.
Oh, right.
And UV contact lenses.
Okay.
And I go, like, health and safety wise, that doesn't look like an awfully good idea. He was like sort of shining these UV LEDs like directly into his eyes, and the sort of like the contact lenses were sort of like, you know, going up and going,
Not sure about that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. And I've got a bit of a sort of like thing about anything to do with eyesight. I mean, we could have gone with like, you know, just like white contact lenses, but it's just fiddly on set, you know, especially if you're doing anything acting. Sort of thing, and it's like, oh, just, you know, I'd rather have the sort of like the months of pain in post-production in a comfy office than the hassle on set. It's so yeah, I mean, just doing it all his eyes in post-production, so, you know, I got that and got a few other characters where, you know, they need sort of stuff doing to them, and yeah, it's just a lot more sort of like post-production and trying to make like an overcast daylight day look a bit more interesting. It's you know, we've got a thing where we've got like a base, and it was, you know, it was okay day, you know, and it's all like, but it doesn't look great, you know. So it's all like color grading. It's like, oh, we're gonna make it so it's like, you know, day for night, or, you know, twilight, and sort of like a storm, and, you know, you go, oh, it looks a lot more atmospheric now, you know, once you get a bit of sound in there and things like that. But it's the biggest sort of like problem is like when you're doing the edit, you know, it's I mean, somebody else is doing the edit, but you can sort of stuff that you do in post-production can, you know, rescue a shot. So, you know, have to be aware of that rather than just sort of discard a shot and go, oh, well, I can't use that shot. I go, well, I could do that shot because I could erase that person or, you know, and I sort of, you know, did it on Minty or, you know, do something to it to sort of like, you know, make the shot sort of, you know, viable. It's, so yeah, that's the sort of, that's the slow bit, you know.
So that's just what you're in at the moment, the slow post-production.
Yeah, that's what we're in at the moment. I mean, yeah, it's all like getting through it. I mean, I think we seem to have, done the sort of like the hard bits first, so hopefully it's you know, a bit of an easier ride sort of like after that.
And when can we look forward to this?
Well, I mean, we're aiming for Thought Bubble, so November.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, when it goes online, I don't know. You know, Minty was a bit of a sort of a sliding sort of release. You know, I added extra bits after. We sort of like we showed it before it went online, because once it goes online with YouTube particularly, you know, you can't edit it, you can't sort of like replace it with another version without losing the, you know, the views or having another link. So it's you know, that's the sort of, that's when you sort of push the button on it. And you know, and also, well, you know, once you've done the edit and like people have done the sound, if you then start you know, messing around with it, then, you know, the sound's got to be redone and sort of, it's, yeah, I mean, basically my sort of, the extent of sort of tweaks afterwards would be things like, things which wouldn't affect the sound. So like I said, oh, I really need to put, you know, another sort of like moon in the sky or something like that. It's not going to affect the sound, you know, but sort of might make it look a bit better or.
Right.
So yeah, as long as it doesn't affect that, then you know I can sort of, you know, tinker away sort of until I'm sort of happy with it. But yeah, it's post production. I'm in the sort of like the pit of despair of post production, where it's, you know, never feels like it's never going to end. I was the same with Judgment. It was sort of you know, it's actual. You know, doing the shoots and stuff, it's like, it's physically sort of like, you know, harder work, but at least it's over in a day, you know, or a day or two. You know, it's sort of you know, once you get
post production goes on and on.
Yeah, yeah, it's just like a slow sort of like, you know, oh god, and especially sort of I mean, I took a couple of months, well, yeah, probably about sort of 6 weeks off, sort of like actually doing any work or sort of turning down work, you know, just so I could like, you know, get a sort of a head start on Strontium Dog. And then sort of like some other work came in and they were sort of like quite sort of, oh, we need help sort of thing. So, yeah, I thought, oh, it'll earn me brownie points. I'd rather be sort of, I'd rather be working on Strontium Dog.
So hopefully for Thought Bubble at Leeds in November.
Yeah, yeah. Right, I mean, we'll, you know, we'll definitely show, you know, we'll show something, you know, it's right. Sort of, yeah, how finessed it is, sort of, yeah. I mean, it's more just really sort of, because we haven't sat down and sort of seen a complete edit of everything yet. We, you know, we've seen bits and pieces, and I think we're looking at about sort of 12, 13 minutes or so. You know, so it's shorter than Minty, but I think it'll be better for that. It'll just all rattle along, you know, less. Long, meaningful walks in North Wales, you know.
Okay, yes, Minty striding through the post-apocalyptic landscape of North Wales.
Yeah, yeah.
Splendid. So I could look forward to that in November.
Yeah, yeah.
Excellent. Thanks, Steve. Well, that will wrap us up for Mega City Book Club for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. Do get in touch with me if you want to join in and talk about a 2000 AD book of your own. We are on social media, so follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and my Just Giving page, or email mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, and you can find all of these links at megacitybookclub.com. Thanks to Brian from the British Invaders podcast for hosting Mega City Book Club. If you're interested in British television, science fiction and other genre television, then check out the podcast British Invaders that I do with Brian. My intro music is Circuit Breaker by the artist RoboDub at thefreemusicarchive.org. And thank you again, Steve, for coming on and choosing such a splendid book to talk about.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's been great fun. So until next time on Mega City Book Club, when we'll be passing judgment on yet another 2000 AD book, it's goodbye from me and...
It's goodbye from me.
Thanks very much. Goodbye.
Cheers.